Welcome to Locked Up Living, a podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Hello there, I'm David Jones, and I'm here with Naomi Murphy, and together with our special guest, Lorna Rhodes. Hello, Lorna.
Hi, Lorna. Really nice to have you on.
Hi, David.
So today, Lorna, I wonder if we could begin by you telling us a bit about your life experience and your work experience. I know you've worked in prisons and I know you've worked in hospitals, but I think you've done much more than that, haven't you?
Well, I'm a cultural anthropologist and a medical anthropologist. And when I started in anthropology, I was a South Asianist. And I worked in, I did my original research in Sri Lanka. And then when I came back to the States, I got interested in psychiatry and particularly public psychiatry in the United States. And I had the opportunity to observe in psychiatric hospitals. And I had been studying curing rituals in Sri Lanka, and the similarity kind of struck me. And so I began kind of gradually shifting over to working in the United States and in hospitals, almost entirely in institutional settings. And I began working at the University of Maryland Medical School for a brief period. I was in their teaching program for medical students. And connected to that was a fairly large public psychiatric hospital. And in that hospital, I began studying the emergency unit. And the first book that I wrote was about that unit and how what public psychiatry was like at that moment. That was in the early 80s, and the deinstitutionalization in the US was really well underway. And the hospital was a real last resort for people who were poor and homeless and sometimes brought in off the streets for acute psychiatry intervention. So that was when I started really thinking about institutions as institutions. And then from there I came to the University of Washington and was at the University of Washington for about 30 years until I retired. And after I published the first book, it just kind of by sheer good fortune, a project sprang up in the university in collaboration with the prison system in Washington State. And it was through that project that I was able to go into the prisons. There was a group of us, and eventually there were just really three of us who were professors in the School of Nursing, David Lovell and David Allen. And our projects initially were very practical and just involved working with the prison staff on specific problems. And then gradually we began to do research, and I was able to do ethnography in the state's prison systems. And that's how I ended up writing my second book, which is called Total Confinement and is about the solitary confinement units in Washington State.
I was struck by the inviting you into a prison. That seems really quite forward thinking in terms of opening the doors and inviting you in there.
Well, it was even more unusual then, I think, because obviously prisons are designed to keep the prisoners in and the public out. And the reason that it could happen was that there had already been someone at the people I was working with were in psychology and social work, nursing, And so that there had been a project, or there had been some connection, because the prisons needed help with assessing mental illness of prisoners coming in. And then the people who were working on that worked with the state legislature to set up this collaboration. And so there were some people, some of the officials in the system were quite happy to have us there. And of course, there were people in the prisons themselves who were a bit horrified by, you know, these academics wandering through.
Can imagine.
So it sounds like your gateway really was the link with the medical services that were had some kind of entrance. Is that right?
Yes. The reason they were interested was because there were so many psychiatrically ill prisoners. They were being kind of overwhelmed, and they had already built a psychiatric hospital kind of within the prison, and they were in the process of setting up a psychiatric unit in another prison. So they were trying to cope with this situation.
Right. I really enjoyed your description of the drive down to the prison that you mentioned, and as you described, moving from large cities to smaller cities to really quite a deprived kind of area where the main industries were the police college and the prison itself. I think that's so powerful and says such a lot about the kind of economic state of the region. How did you make the contact with Mr. Larson?
So the reason I was able to do what I did, so I guess I should maybe back up and say that Washington State had at the time had, still has five of these solitary confinement units in different maximum security prisons. So we were kind of, because of what we were doing, we were able to go into these different prisons, which is unusual, because we had a view of the whole system. And at the same time, one of the projects that my colleague David Lovell and I worked on was somewhat of a naive project, I have to say. We had the idea that, we realized that when people started talking about what was the problem with mentally ill prisoners, what they were particularly preoccupied with was behavior problems. That what's called behavior problems, right? Which is not technically speaking a psychiatric diagnosis. And there was just this gray area of those prisoners, which I'm sure everyone who's ever worked in a prison knows about this. And everyone talked to us about this. This was the problem they wanted solved. And of course it was the problem that we couldn't solve. And so we had the idea that the workers in the prisons themselves had the most expertise on this, and that the different prisons were quite separate from each other. You know, like just an ordinary person working in one unit wouldn't go and visit other prisons. So we made a team, they set this up and allowed us to do this, which was extraordinary actually. And we created a team by interviewing workers who did different things. The social worker and the line staff and the, just different positions. And then we worked together with all of them. And what we wanted to have was a team that they could form small teams and go into the prisons to address these behavior issues and address the staff especially. It was, the thing itself was hugely successful. The people on the team really liked it, but the prisons didn't want to ask for help. Each individual prison was reluctant to bring in outsiders for their worst problems. So that was what it eventually foundered on that. But in the course of that, we met people in each prison. And that was really what the secret of what made it possible for me to do the work, is that we knew people and they were at different levels of the organization. In the course of all that, I met Larson, who was at a lower, his official position was greater at the point when I worked with him on that solitary confinement unit.
He was at a fairly high level, was he? Manager of that unit or of?
He was the manager of that unit.
Mm. Had he already begun his, for want of a better word, experiment?
Oh, yes. Yes, he had already begun and gotten quite far with his experiment by the time I showed up.
Right. So what did he actually do?
What did he do with this unit? The yes. history of that?
Yeah.
Oh, he, so this was I'm trying to remember how many people, about 100 people, 100 men were in this unit. And it had, and it wasn't, the prison had been built, this was the first of these units that had been built in Washington State. So it wasn't the most hardened or the most, it was a typical one, but the facility was older, which I think might've affected the situation as well. And the prisoners, and so it had just become a war inside that. He described it as a war, and all the staff said, we were in a war. And there eventually was a riot, basically. And the prisoners, one of the prisoners got up, the ceilings of the cells weren't fully tight. And so I think he got up through the shower ceiling in the shower, went after the electrical system. It was just a complete mess. And so they had reached sort of an end point or a limit of what one of these units can do to contain the people in it. And that was the point at which Larson took over the unit. And he was a very determined administrator and spent long hours there and just really persuaded his staff that they could change the whole tone of the place.
Okay, we'll come to that in a minute because that's terribly important. But I still like to get a bit of a picture because, you know, I've watched too many films in my life. So I've got an image of 100 or so separate cells with walls and bars at the front. Is that about right?
Yes, it's completely separate. Partially, they're not soundproof, but when you go into one with the cell door closed, they have a muffled feeling inside. The walls are thick, they're made out of concrete. There's a narrow window. In some facilities, they glaze the windows so that you can't look out at all, but not this particular one. The doors are heavy duty doors. They don't have bars. They have a cuff port, which is like a little door that you can put a meal tray through and you can cuff someone through it. And they have a toilet and often the lights, and they have lights that don't fully turn off at night. So there's a,
yeah,
there's an ambient light in these places.
Right.
So they can be very. Yes. No, it's not a problem of lack of privacy. It's not the same as, maybe it's worth saying that prisons have always had segregation units. And in, at least in this state, the way that's just, you know, that's the word for it. And just plain old segregation as it was cells with bars and people in individual cells usually, but not so tightly contained. But this is more like a holding cell. So it's very, you can hear, but it can get very noisy on these units, but you can't really, you have to go right up to the door to talk to somebody. And the other person has to be right on the other side of the door.
Right.
But, you know, I should say that these places are designed differently in different parts of the United States. And I visited one in England, too, and it was designed differently. So there's differences in the doors and the way the cells are organized and in how much the prisoners are let out of their cells. All those things can vary. But here in this country, it's 23 hours a day inside the cell.
Which one did you go to in England? Out of curiosity.
Oh, David, I forgot the name of it.
Probably Wood Hill,
was it? The man who was the captain at Grendon took me there, and it was the first time I came.
Right. Yeah, it was probably Wood Hill. That would be the nearest one.
Wood Hill. Hmm. It was Wood Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there were hardly any people there, any prisoners in that unit.
No, and small doors. I remember small doors everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's great. I've got a picture in my mind now of what this is like. Then the next thing that you mentioned was that Larson persuaded the staff. Now, that sounds really simple when it rolls off your tongue like that. But in my experience, it's jolly difficult to change the kind of approach and the attitude of staff in those really quite challenging and testing situations. How do you think he went about that?
Well, I missed the beginning of it, so I wasn't there when he was trying to persuade them. And I think I can't imagine that an anthropologist sitting in the room would have been helpful while that was happening either. By the time I got there, they were quite proud of what they were doing, but I think how he did it, I know one of the ways he did it is that he used the idea of what is the human? What is the human thing to do? How do we think of these people as human beings? And he was very fond of the metaphor of the dog pound. He loves dogs. And he would talk about how this is like a dog pound and we're treating them worse than we treat the dogs. And somehow, I think there were some very thoughtful and bright people on his staff who had just gotten caught up in a situation that was so kind of deadly. And also, they felt so unsupported because it's dangerous for the staff. If the facility isn't run tightly, then the staff feel that no one is supporting them, that there's no one on their side. And so I think he probably also did a good job of making it clear that he was on their side. And a lot of this has to do with equipment and, you know, whether the place is run well enough so that someone doesn't find himself in a dangerous situation. So I think it was those two things. And also Larson was was extremely conscientious in his own work. So he didn't, when he got there, there were these big stacks of grievances piled up and other kinds of issues piled up, and he would stay late until he just dealt with it. So I think it was a lot of those things, being more present.
Well, I wondered, Lorna, when I read your paper, actually, and you talk about the kind of like the great energy that he had, and it did make me wonder about whether units like this that try and do something different, whether that requires a different kind of temperament or character for the staff that work there in order to create that sort of a different kind of service.
I think one of the great puzzles of prisons in general, of an entire institutional world, is to what extent individuals make a difference and to what extent the institutional structure makes a difference and the sort of social structure that it's embedded in. And that would include the political structure, so many things like that. And so I actually, if I could resolve that question, I'd be thrilled, but I don't think it's easily resolved. I don't think this could have happened without Larson's personality, but I also think that Larson maybe couldn't have done it without certain other things in place. And, you know, for instance, at the time, I think the administration of the prison system was not trying to thwart him. which often happens. The political mood in the United States wasn't quite as, it's been very punitive all along. So I don't want to minimize that at all, but I think there was I think things maybe had changed or shifted slightly, or we wouldn't even have been there and doing the things we were doing. So definitely a forceful personality has something to do with it, and integrity on the part of the staff as people. And that's always being undermined by other staff who are either not on board with the project, or they lack that force or integrity. So it's constantly shifting. And Larson retired, and it didn't, they retained some of his innovations still. And now I think Washington State has improved the situation with these units quite a lot. But it didn't continue after he left the way he had it, by any means.
That's really interesting.
Oh, go on, David.
No, go on, carry on about Larson.
I think Larson's innovation that might have made the most difference is they call them walk-arounds, there's other names that people give these things, but it's where the staff walks around these units every morning and visits every cell. And Larson did this himself, and that's what's very hard to keep doing in an instance, you know, because the administrator and the doesn't feel that he really needs to do that. He delegates that. But Larson did it along with his staff every morning at 8 o'clock.
And I think that's such an interesting observation, because I think there's a real pressure for the more senior managers to be hands off and not be as involved. And yet there's something really important about having that kind of presence of being in the unit, isn't there? And engaged and interested, and I guess communicating some kind of safety.
Yes. And from the point of view of the prisoners, one of the most difficult things about being locked up in one of these units is that you can't do anything about anything that's wrong. Your headphones break, or you can't contact your mother. The weekly call is at the wrong time. There's tiny things from an outside perspective, things that wouldn't make someone in their living room frantic. But if you're locked in a cell, it makes you frantic. And so that's part of what happens, is that these frustrations and angers just build up over time. And by going from cell to cell and then dealing immediately with what the prisoners brought up, the whole place calmed down.
And you also spoke about his integrity, and I guess that's also important, I imagine.
Yes.
The thing I was wondering about was, and I think you hinted at it really, was the nature of the walk around. It took place regularly, so it was to be expected. And it seems to me it's important to get the balance right. So it's not just the boss, but it's the team who are working there. So the prison officers, did they go round with him?
Yes, different people would do it at different times. The lieutenant, the corrections counselor, the officers, of course, are running the system. The system is like a machine in a supermax unit. So it doesn't really allow them to break off and just do those things. But occasionally, yes, an officer too. Mm. Mostly, though, it was the administrative staff of the unit.
So time is very regimented, isn't it, in these places. Were there any structures kind of introduced to maintain a level of support for those kind of coalface staff? I'm thinking, groups which a social worker might have facilitated or something like that.
There's counseling if there's after an incident. So, there are people who help with that, but I don't think there is the kind of support that would help staff. And, one thing that we felt would be good would be if the shifts could meet, you know, which happens in hospitals, right? There's a meeting of the two shifts as they transfer.
Yes.
But it doesn't happen. I'm not sure if it's happening now, but that was one of the things that we noticed, is that the staff on the shifts didn't have a chance to talk to each other. So there would be tension among the three shifts over who had gotten what done on the previous one, you know, that kind of thing, which is just endemic in institutional practice. And that's something that, because of what you say, because of the tight timing and the tight scheduling of staff, it's hard to make that happen.
Perhaps the main thing I picked up from your paper was that the important factor was that people talk to each other, talking took place. So prisoners had the opportunity to talk to someone, and that seemed to have been a major change.
Yes. Yes, because not talking to prisoners is part of the, well, it's not, I don't want to say that it, I don't want to say that the staff don't talk to the prisoners, because actually they do. But being concerned that the prisoners are lying to you is part of the culture of prison staff. And so it makes talking problematic. Hmm. And there's a lot of emphasis here anyway on the idea of manipulation, and how manipulation is what you always have to be careful that, you know, you always have to be careful it's not happening to you. Hmm. And so it sets up from the beginning, right from the moment the officers are trained, it sets up a set of restrictions on talk and fears around it.
Hmm. So do you think the officer staff felt it was a successful process that they were running?
You mean once these changes had happened?
Yeah.
I think there were differences of opinion among the staff, and I don't think it was possible for me to know about all of those, because I was clearly, you know, kind of aligned with the people who had changed things. And actually, just as an ethnographer, you're always in a situation where there's different alignments and different associations, and you have to kind of navigate. And I don't think it's realistic to think that in an institution like that, you're going to know what everybody thinks. And something that helped me was that I could go to the different institutions and I had different relationships in each one. And so that created, so the book I wrote has a picture of, there's more disgruntled staff speaking in some of the other prisons that I visited. But in this one, I think because of the sort of cohesion of Larson's, the paradigm was cohesive that Larson was putting out. And I think the staff weren't talking, the staff who didn't like it weren't talking a lot. So I didn't hear as much about that as I would have liked.
Right.
But I think there were staff who didn't like it.
Yeah, they might have been talking somewhere else, of course. I expect they were.
Yes, I imagine so.
But did it feel like a safe place?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Maximum custody unit like that is sometimes safer than other units because everyone is locked into a cell.
Yes. Hmm. Could they communicate at all, the prisoners?
You mean between the cells?
Yes.
Yes, they could. They could shout out of their cells. And if you had a compatible person right next to you, you could not chat casually, because it took effort to make yourself heard. But yes, they talked to each other and called out to each other. The staff were, there's sort of a war against phishing in prisons. And phishing is where you send notes by slipping them on, you know, putting them on a string and slipping them under your cell door. So this unit, I think, had pretty much prevented phishing at that point, because they construct the doors so that you can't do it.
Right. Yeah. Yes, a lot of thought must have gone into that, but not into making the ceiling safe. Anyway,
that's
great. And then I was fortunate enough to read your book, and then we made contact, and eventually you came over and spent some time at Crendon, didn't you?
Yes, for which I have you entirely to thank. And the reason that Crendon was so striking to me is that Crendon has the emphasis on Crendon is on talking. So I had been studying these places where the prisoners were so isolated. And when I visited Crendon, I was just, and I know I'm not the first visitor to Crendon to have this experience. People are astounded by the place because it's so relaxed and because the prisoners and the staff are talking to each other so intimately.
Mm. There's a real warmth about you, Lorna, when you talk about Crendon. That comes through in your writing as well. It obviously has really captured your imagination. And, you know, we just skirted with the idea of success. And I wondered whether you would consider Crendon a success.
Yes, I thought Crendon was a success. I mean, I've certainly read the criticism that it's not quite as successful as people say, right? I mean, that, you know, prisoners do come back and that it takes a really long time for someone to be able to move out of Crendon into the world again, that it's too expensive. I mean, there's certainly ways that people can be skeptical of Crendon, but I did find it remarkable. And I was there for a month, every workday for a month for the working day. And I interviewed the prisoners. And one thing that struck me, they aren't really different. The prisoners in maximum security, these high custody institutions in the United States, you know, they're called the worst of the worst. And some of them are very violent men. But actually, some of them are just, they're mentally ill, or there's other issues. They've accumulated many infractions in the prison system. So it's, in some ways, Crendon has more very violent people in it than a maximum security prison in the US. And that, so that more or less the same population, but such different outcomes in terms of people's ability to interact with each other and understand themselves and all of the things that Crendon allows for.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you touch on in one of your papers is in the repetition entropy and the institutional interior. And mm-hmm. you, I suppose when I was reading that, you talk about camps as being used to hold people who are seen as the other. And that made me wonder whether part of the work of units such as Crendon is whether they can shift society's perceptions of the people who are in them from other to somebody who can belong. So you just referred to kind of like the most dangerous or the lowest of the low. And I think in one paper you used the depiction of those people as being garbage or weeds, not by you, but by society. And I wondered, you know, is part of the job of places like Crendon to try and shift society's perception of those individuals? And is that even possible?
I was going to say, changing opinion is one of the things that Naomi and I thought we ought to set out to try and achieve. But in saying that, I think we realised just how difficult it is doing that.
Yes, I think it's very difficult. I think it may be that larger changes in the society are what make a difference. And, you know, for instance, it's very expensive to incarcerate, you know, almost 2.5 million people, as in the United States. And as economic conditions change, there is a change of feeling about whether low-level criminals should be in these institutions. And there have been governors here releasing people who are, you know, incarcerated, say, for marijuana crimes, drug possession, things like that. So I do think there's a larger context for how people see prisons and how people see prisoners. But that's not the same as the question of, you know, can violent people take up a place in society or be understood differently than the way they are? And yeah, I'm not sure the answer to that. I think if what happens at Grendon could be more visible, it might change some people's feelings about it, because when you see the prisoners there, I think some of them clearly were very dangerous and probably perhaps could be again. But Grendon provides this depth of understanding of what happens to people to make them that way. And that's something that just is not available, I think. It's as though someone is vulnerable until they're 15 or 16, and then they change into a completely different type of being in the public imagination.
Absolutely. And I suppose I was wondering whether the role of places like Grendon is to kind of try and humanize these people, but I'm curious about whether society will even allow that, because whether there's more, it's more functional for society to keep those people as other rather than to see them as being part of us and like us.
Yes, I do think people are reluctant to see them as like us, that you yourself could have any of those feelings or impulses. I think that is part of it. Well, in one thing that I would hear in the prison system here, because the prisons are sited in these rural areas, and the workers are often some of the workers are from similar backgrounds to the prisoners. It's not a drastic difference at all. Sometimes someone would say that he ran into a prisoner he went to high school with. And so the prison workers would say, well, I had a hard childhood. You know, my background isn't any different from that guy, but I made the choice not to be a bad person, which raises the whole question of, you know, people's, of the sort of theory of choice that we operate on as a society to understand people's behavior. And so if you come from that perspective, you're very resistant to the idea that context is related to how people behave.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I suppose another thought that comes to mind in relation to that and from previous conversations that David and I have had has been about whether it's possible to allow these people to then be successful at creating change and difference, you know, whether we're really willing to allow that at all, any belief in that?
Yes. And I don't think, you know, Grendon, there isn't really a way for Grendon to broadcast its community meetings, for instance, so that you could, so it sounds kind of unbelievable from the outside. I mean, one thing that was surprising to me at Grendon was that the community meetings are a large circle, you know, on benches benches. And the prisoners and the staff would sit very close together, I mean, leaning against each other. And this was so different from anything that I had ever seen in a prison here, that it really struck me that some level of confidence that no one was going to act out was there in the room among everyone, so that, you know, the staff could just be wedged in among the prisoners.
Sounds like it was a really profound experience for you.
Well, I had this really intense contrast to work with. Mm.
Sorry, David.
I was going to say, it is interesting what you're saying about that feeling of safety, because I certainly felt that throughout the 5-6 years that I worked there. I don't think I really ever felt unsafe. And that was partly because of the kind of fairly continual style of pretty good behavior, but also because I had some sort of trust that if something happened and somebody attacked me, there would be lots of people around who would pull them off, as it were. So it felt quite secure. I mean, in retrospect, not sure we'd say that now, but for me to be sitting 4 floors up in a group with 9 or 10 men on my own for, you know, an hour and a half. So it always felt safe. In contrast, I can compare it with another prison I worked, where I worked in a discrete unit, so a small unit within a much bigger high category prison. And as soon as I left, you know, my own little unit, it didn't feel safe at all. I always had to be on my guard and careful about what was going on.
Yes, the prisoners at Grendon told me that. They said, you know, it's fine here. We wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't let somebody do anything. And I think Grendon, you know, Grendon sets this up. It's very interesting. Almost everyone I met there said, among the prisoners, said, what I couldn't believe about Grendon was that when I got there, the officer shook my hand. So it's set up to tell people that they're going to be treated differently and that they aren't the same kind of person as they were before they stepped through the gate.
Yeah, and you write about how, I guess, initially jarring for the men that is, that it's so different to what they expect, what they've come to expect in prison, that it's almost frightening in itself.
Yes, they did say that Grendon can be very disconcerting and make you anxious, and that the work there is very hard, it's much harder to be there because of the psychological work that you are doing.
And yet, I think one of the challenges that places like Grendon have, and no doubt Mr. Larson, they end up with a reputation for being too soft, don't they? The idea being that they're soft places to work. Yes. And I wondered what you'd discerned about other people's attitude to Grendon, the work that Mr. Larson was doing in the Supermax, what you picked up on other people's perceptions of that work. How do you think they felt about it?
In the prisons here, of course, being soft was a theme that came up often. And I think for Larson, it was something. He was a fairly forceful individual. So I don't think it was so much that he was soft, but that there's this tremendous danger of letting your guard down about anything. And so that theme was always there for any prison worker that I talked to here. Although, I mean, there's an awful lot of variations within prison. It's really important to say that. There's tremendous differences. They all look kind of alike, but depending on so many things that, you know, not everybody was worried about talking to prisoners, for instance, despite the training in manipulation. And I had the impression that at Grendon that not everybody was feeling so, at least among the officers, not everybody thought it was the greatest sort of institution. One officer told me that he admired American prisoners and thought that Britain should bring back the death penalty.
There was a continual anxiety, and maybe that was a mixed anxiety, actually, now you say that Grendon would be abolished and we'd introduce supermax prisons all over the place, just like you have in the USA. And of course, we've done that to some extent. We haven't closed Grendon yet, but we've got several supermax type prisons around the place.
Well, since I don't live in Britain, I wondered, you know, what keeps Grendon there? How is it that Grendon is still there?
You took the question right out of my mouth, because I was wondering that's partly how David and I came to be doing this podcast, was a curiosity about what's made Grendon sustainable when other discrete units might not stay the course. And it sounds like Mr. Larson's work didn't quite stay the course. So while there's some fragments there, that it hasn't stayed the course in the same way. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, one is, which I think I might have gotten from David in the first place, is that Grendon doesn't have a larger prison around it. It's freestanding. And so the culture of Grendon, one person told me that it's in the walls, that the way you're supposed to behave at Grendon is seeping out of the walls because it's so old and it's been doing this for so long that when people walk in there, this is how it's done. And I don't see how you could get that same effect in a discrete unit within a larger prison system, because there's so much intersection between the culture of the larger prison system and the necessities of it, you know, that through that unit is permeable. You can't make it completely separate. So that has to be one of the reasons that Grendon has survived or has maintained itself without losing its mission.
I think that's right, because I think I think there's a number of discrete units that tend to end up being eaten up by their host institution. And I think whilst Grendon sits within the larger prison service, the fact it has that perimeter around it probably does create some sense of boundary.
Yeah, we were talking to Michael Brooks the other day. Do you remember Michael?
I do.
Yes. So we had a long conversation with him, and he partly agreed, but he also thought that Grendon was under just as much threat as any other type of institution and required work, hard work, negotiating with the outside world. And of course, that was part of his job, together with Peter Bennett, who you'll also remember. So they felt that was the task of the governor and the head of therapy, was negotiating to keep the dogs at bay, if that's a fair comment to make.
And yes, and I thought that was going on. That was going on when I was there. Yeah. And it was clear that there were changes there's so many obvious things that can happen that Grendon itself doesn't have control over. You know, how many hours to lock people up, for instance, or all sorts of things.
Well, I just wondered as well whether that part of that theme around being a whole prison, I wonder whether that allows the prison service to feel it has ownership of what happens in the unit, in the prison. Whereas I guess for these discrete units, quite often that's seen as being psychology taking over. So there can be a bit of a power tussle between the different disciplines. I wondered if that was relevant to Grendon's success and continuity.
Well, the tussle between psychology and custody, you know, is age old, right? And in the prisons here, of course, custody had the upper hand, but mental health, what's called mental health here, really did have some, the mental health workers could carve out a territory, and it wasn't a freestanding territory at all. And they didn't have control over a lot of aspects, but they could still, I used the image of a circle, you know, the goal to form a circle. And it turns out, of course, in Grendon too, that's the circle. It's the circle that signifies that this is about care and the psychological aspects of a person, as opposed to whether they are counted, for instance, or are in cuffs and all the other parts of running a prison. So, you know, the paramilitary side of the prison and the mental health side are in tension. And Grendon started from a different position and seems to have defined itself as a territory that's separate from, it's not separate from custody, but there's some depth to the idea that it has autonomy as a psychological rather than custodial institution. Obviously, though, that's going to be a struggle. It can't resolve itself.
No. And I recently read Michelle Gelfand's book, Rule Makers, Rule Breakers. And she argues that the public is drawn towards more authoritarian ideals during times of danger and threat. Given kind of like COVID-19 and the inevitable financial hardship that's to follow, do you think that's going to threaten the existence of environments like Grendon, which might be more likely to thrive during the relaxation of relative safety?
Yes, I think that it probably is a possibility. And there's also the economic aspect of this, that as the economy gets more disrupted, there's less coming in for anything in these big agencies, for any of these big agencies, actually. And so I can imagine trimming off the things that seem less essential, and a prison like Grendon might seem less essential, or a psychiatric unit, or, you know, there are a lot of ways that you could start to trim around the edges and keep just the more intense custodial functions. I hope that's not what happens, but I can imagine it too.
Yeah, it's quite sobering, isn't it?
Yeah.
If someone asked you for advice about setting up a unit such as this that might be sustainable, what words of wisdom would you share? How would you create something that might last?
One of the things we wanted to do in our projects with the Department of Corrections was to try to address the behavior problem issue, because it's so so intractable, so difficult for people to solve, and it tends to influence everything around it. Mm-hmm. So we met over quite a long period of time to design a unit that would do this. And we met with the staff at the psychiatric prison, and we had, you know, an architect, the prison builders come, and all of the different people with a stake in something like that. And the unit that we designed was so expensive. I mean, to do that right, yeah. it was just a complete utopian exercise. So you know, it was like an experience of having the cold water of practicality pour it over your head. So I don't know that it would have to be like that. I mean, part of what made that happen was the custodial interest in having everything be completely risk-free. And it's very difficult to get past that. I mean, I guess if the question is, how would you change the system as a whole? One way to change it as a whole is to find some other way of dealing with petty crime or less dangerous crime. And that would free up money to do better by the people who are disturbed and who actually do need a lot of support to get out of prison and be able to function in the community. I think that would be... That seems like the first step to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I also wonder why things need to be so expensive, because one of the things that we found over here was that, because as I'm sure you know, we opened up a number of high secure units, two in special hospitals, and two in prison settings. The special hospital settings were enormously expensive, and eventually they were both, I think they were both closed, weren't they? I mean, and the money was transferred into the prison system with the idea that you could enhance certain prison activities with the funds coming from these terribly expensive other units. And you'll remember coming, because we went to Millfield together, didn't we? Over in East London, and I think the cost there was something like four times that of running Crendon. So,
really?
Yeah, very expensive. And of course, the ones in special hospitals, the high secure ones, were even more expensive. So I think we're still struggling to find the right balance. So it certainly improved having these really quite creative units in prison settings, and there's quite a number now. I mean, Naomi's been working in one for 17 years, for example. But I'm not sure we've really got the balance proper at the moment. What do you think, Naomi?
No, I think you're right. I mean, our unit is basically a converted prison wing, which at the same time as these two swanky special purpose-built hospital units were being built. So I think it is possible to do things on a shoestring, but I also share the anxiety that so long as the prison service has also got to meet the demands of many, many, many kind of like petty offenders, that actually it doesn't allow resources to be used in a way that actually means that they get value for money, where there is a chance to actually change people's lives for the better. It's going to require some massive changes, I think, for that to happen.
Hmm. Yeah. My impression of Crendon, I didn't get into what the budget of Crendon is. And I'm assuming it's more expensive because of the professional staff there, but it didn't seem like a fancy or terribly expensive prison.
No.
I mean, it's kind of a simple place in some ways, without some of the bells and whistles of more secure prisons.
I think what's interesting is that people have an idea of how much it costs to keep a prisoner in the different kinds of prisons. And you look at places like Crendon or the Fens where I work, and you see that there's a huge difference in how much it, or what seems like a huge difference. But actually what that doesn't take into account is the costs that are reduced in terms of the damage to property or individuals. Mm-hmm. And it's all those other costs that in some ways are invisible and don't get counted in. And I think one of my beliefs is that actually when people are in units like Crendon or the Fens, their behaviour changes and they do not have the same destructive impact on other people and the system. And I think the system can forget the destructive potential of those individuals. So actually, if a service works well like Crendon, it almost seems as though these people didn't really need Crendon because they weren't that bad after all. You know, it can be hard.
Yes, that's true. It's very expensive if someone in prison is disturbed or destructive, and it's also very expensive when people get out who end up in homeless shelters, or you know, they might not go back to prison, but it doesn't mean that there's not support that goes into that kind of problem too.
Absolutely. And I think it's a shame that we end up having to talk about the finance of that, because ultimately we're also talking about people's lives, aren't we? Whether that be the life of the person who's committed the crime or other potential victims, and the impact, you know, the damage and distress that can be caused. But ultimately it often feels like it's the money that talks.
Yes, it does seem to be true. And the amount of pain and distress and discrimination and all the other things that are involved in these systems is glossed over, or, you know, it's not as visible. And also what you say is true. There are delayed forms of pain and suffering that don't show up, not just don't show up in prison budgets, but they don't show up when you go into a unit where everybody is, you know, nicely tucked into cells. You can't see, unless you really work at it, you can't see what's being produced by these places. And it's this is not the best way to go about this at all.
No, one of the things that David and I are really interested in was well-being and resilience. And you touch on how, or the, certainly the insinuation in your paper is that being treated as a human, how much better that is for the well-being of the prisoner. But I was also curious about whether you thought there was an impact on the well-being of staff working in those places.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Especially if there's this huge contrast, the way there was at the prison I described, where there had been a change, then the staff talked about it. And prison staff suffer from real after effects or effects of their work. I said after effects because the most common thing we heard was, you know, the problem of taking it home with you and all the different ways that taking it home with you can affect your family and yourself. Mm. And there's small things like you won't sit in a restaurant unless your back is against the wall. I used to have some of the people who worked in the prison come and talk to my classes at the University of Washington, and we'd go out to lunch and they would all line themselves up with their backs to the wall, and they knew it. They would laugh about it and they'd say, you know, I can't settle down until my back's to the wall. And that's a small thing, but it's not that small a thing. It changes a person's life in the outside world. And so there's lots of effects on the people who work in the prisons. And the people who were in that unit where it changed did talk about the change in their feeling about their job, because it wasn't, you didn't have to go in and one guy said, you know, you didn't have to suit up for the war when you walked into the through the gate.
So it makes me think, yeah, that there are dynamics in a prison, the institution of the kind you're describing, which are much more dysfunctional than they need to be, and that fairly simple changes on a kind of broadcast scale could make a difference. There you
are. Yeah, I do think that, actually. I think you can change the living conditions of the prisoners in small ways that make a difference. And of course, big ways would be good too. And you can change the experience of the staff. I think, you know, one of the kind of ambiguities in prison management is that people need to have some contact with each other in groups. And if you have an institution that isolates people so that they can't actually sit down together and talk to each other, I think that's a way that you're perpetuating stress. I mean, stress from all sides, for everybody. It kind of goes to the question of, could you arrange to have a staff meeting at the shift change? And could you arrange for the people in supermax prisons to meet with each other under some circumstances? Yeah. And prisons are starting, I mean, that happens in some prisons, and Washington State has changed that and set up, you know, special kind of classrooms and ways of having people in the same room. But I think that's a tremendous, over time, it's a tremendous stressor. Mm. That could be, it wouldn't be terribly difficult or expensive, I don't think, to change.
I think we're getting towards the end. We would like to ask you what one thing you would recommend, what one thing has inspired you, be it a book or a film or a place. Does anything come to mind?
Well, you clued me into this question ahead of time, so I had a chance to think about it. And it didn't take long to come up with the book that affected me in my work in the prisons. It's a book called it's called Ghostly Matters by Avery Gordon. Mm-hmm. And it's and the subtitle is Haunting and the Sociological Imagination.
Right.
And it's that idea that she weaves through this book, that the institutional life of a society is haunted in various ways. And one way is by the past, of course, and its past. And another way is by various kinds of absences and disappearances. So the book itself is not about prisons at all, or But it has a psychoanalytic basis, I guess. She talks about that, and she has these very, it's a difficult book, but very inspiring passages about the sort of mysterious ways. I mean, all of the things we've been talking about are unresolved questions, right? And how do you think about why they persist and what makes it difficult to understand the dynamics of these places? And so she doesn't try to solve things in a straightforward way. And instead she says, what sorts of mysteries lie behind these places? And how can we approach them? Maybe we need to approach them in a different way.
Sounds an intriguing book.
It does indeed.
Thank you so much, Lorna. It's been really, really lovely to talk with you and hear about your experiences. Really fascinating. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Yes, thank you both. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Yeah, me too. It's been lovely to talk to you and to see you too.
Well, that was really enjoyable. I've known Lorna for quite a while now. And what I really love is her style of writing, the descriptive style of her writing, which in the particular paper we were looking at even describes the drive down to the prison that she was visiting and how the landscape changed as she reached this area of land, which was clearly an impoverished area of the country. And you could begin to understand how the local people depended upon this kind of prison industry. I was really struck by that.
I think that's a really interesting observation, because I think so much of what we end up reading about forensic settings can be quite sterile. And I think you're right, there's a storytelling quality to how Lorna describes her work, but not the storytelling that bears a resemblance to truth, obviously, rather than another kind of storytelling. And I suppose I also took from that kind of storytelling kind of narrative the idea that of certain personalities, and you have this sense of this charismatic leader and how important that was in terms of the work. But obviously that then raises the question of how you manage to implement change against a system that might be quite resistant if you don't have a charismatic leader to be able to push those ideas forward and chip away at something that's quite resistant.
Quite. And the final point that she brought out right towards the end was to do with the value of staff meeting together and to do that routinely, which apparently doesn't happen in settings in American prisons and probably doesn't happen so often in British prisons either. So something that's fairly simple to implement, having staff meeting together.
Yes, yes.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.